This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 14th of November. I'm Melissa Idris. I'll be keeping you company all the way till 10 o'clock this morning. I've got Brian Flanders and Joyce Coe in the studio with me. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hi. All right, well, let's kick off the show with a look at news overnight. Now, the Myanmar army has released the results of an internal investigation in which it exonerates itself of blame regarding the Rohingya crisis. So the army has come out with this report saying that it denies killing any Rohingya people, it denies burning their villages or raping women and girls, and it denies stealing possessions. Now, this report has gotten some backlash from the international community. I believe the UN had called this Rohingya crisis a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. And according to reports from the BBC, these assertions from the military directly contradicts evidence seen by BBC correspondents when doing reporting in Myanmar.
Yeah, well, we didn't exactly expect them to say that they were guilty. So it's rather unfortunate that they've taken this stand, but not entirely surprising at all.
Yeah, I think it's really, I agree with you. It's not surprising considering the source, but it really does show that despite all this international pressure, the Myanmar military is still showing that it has no intention of taking any accountability for the crisis.
Yeah, probably still in denial. But it's good to have media to go on the ground and suss out what's happening.
But you know, Joyce, what we've heard from the media, the reporters who have gone to the ground, it's very controlled. So they can only see what the Myanmar military want them to see. And they're taken to very specific locations. Right now, there's no, I think, fact finders or international independent fact finders from the UN or observers are able to actually go and make an assessment on the ground. So really, it's a limited view of what reporters can report on.
But at least people like Bob Geldof, for example, have taken a principled stand to bring light to the attention the abuses at Myanmar. And he's returned a prestigious award for, I believe, the freedom of the city of Dublin because Aung San Suu Kyi was given that award previously.
Yeah, so musician and philanthropist Bob Geldof, he was given this award and then now he's saying, look, I don't want to, I'm giving it up in protest because Aung San Suu Kyi holds the same honour. And she said, and he says her association with the city of Dublin shames us all, according to a statement that he made to the BBC. We honoured her and now she appalls and shames us. So really quite strong statements coming from, again, the international community, whether that's going to be enough for Myanmar to take responsibility for the Rohingya crisis is another matter. Okay, we're coming up to 4 minutes past 6 o'clock and after this, we'll take a look at Trump's visit to Asia. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. It's coming up to 10 minutes past 6 o'clock. That was Flashlight by Parliament. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go and Brian Fernandez this morning. And we're taking a look at a recent article in the Nikkei Asian by Tan Sri Munir Majid, the chair of the ASEAN Business Advisory Council of Malaysia. Now, this article had him saying that too much time was spent at meetings during Trump's visit to the region, to Asia, talking about strategic messages.
Yeah, so what he argued is basically that what is really needed from the US is really a move away from a focus on military and strategic initiatives, really to trump all their economic investments and the contributions that they are making on the ground. Now, he talks about, and one of the interesting things about this article is the fact that, which is why, you know, we're discussing this so early in the morning, is the fact that the U.S. actually invested last year $12.12 billion in the region, in contrast to actual numbers from China, which only total $9.8 billion. So the messaging out there is, oh, China is investing this huge amount of money, but the reality is that the U.S. is still the largest investor in ASEAN.
Yeah, but China is upping its investment into the region, whereas America is not upping its investment.
No, that's right, Joyce. And that's one of the key thing with his messages. He says that basically now the U.S. needs to look at and see, okay, to ensure a balance in the region, that the U.S. should then trump its economic investments and also then look at announcing similar initiatives or competing initiatives in the region, like the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, but maybe the U.S. doesn't want to do that. I mean, Trump has already said clear that he wants America first. He's already said that he wants to bring back businesses to America. So maybe America just doesn't want to do that. And
well, what we've seen for comments made by Trump during this kind of trip, the state trip to Asia this past week, is that essentially, in a nutshell, nations of the Asian region or nations of the world essentially must rally behind the US and confront the nuclear threat from North Korea, but they should expect America to go its own way when it comes to trade.
Yeah.
Essentially, he's saying that, well, you know, let's unite on North Korea, but I'm going to go on it alone when it comes to trade. And we've seen that with the revival of the TPP without the US involved.
Yeah, and it's great that we have China there.
Well, the thing is, so my personal view is really, as small nations, we need to have a balance. We need to look, we need to ensure that, and for us as Malaysia, we're too small to be important enough. But collectively as ASEAN, we are significant. There's, you know, 600 over million people in ASEAN. So what we really need to do is band together and ensure that it's not just China that's investing, it's the US, it's also Japan, because they're economically powerful nations that then will spur development of the region as a whole. If we're only dependent on China, China starts to dictate terms to us.
Yeah, but US has already made clear, as Melissa has said during his visit, that when it comes to economic trade and all that, it's America first in a way. They want to bring back money to America. There's a reason why he's looking at the tax cuts and all these other things.
Yeah, so that's the crux of the article. The crux of the article, basically, and Tan Sri Munir says that the U.S. should not take that view. It should take an opposing view, the traditional view, you know, the Barack Obama view, for example, which is basically that pivot to Asia. Asia is important. Asia is a rising economic power, and that's what they should be doing. So the current path is really the wrong path, not only for the U.S., but the wrong path for our region.
That's true, but Barack Obama is not president right now. It's Donald Trump.
Well, and Trump is undoing all of Obama's policies.
Yes.
But fair enough. I mean, what I found interesting, I guess, towards this, 12-day five-nation tour of Asia that Donald Trump is on, is that the use of the term, I think he uses Indo-Asia, as opposed to Asia, sorry, Indo-Pacific, as opposed to Asia-Pacific. You know, we normally say, oh, the region is Asia-Pacific, but Trump has chosen to call it the Indo-Pacific region. And no details have come out as to why he's chosen to call it, but there's speculation that perhaps America is looking to revive this kind of four-way alliance between Japan, Australia, India, and the U.S. As a kind of to stem the rising tide of China.
And Melissa, that's a very good point, because if you take a step back and you look at the defense cooperation, the U.S. has upped defense cooperation, particularly in recent years with Japan and also particularly India.
Yeah, they're not backing down when it comes to those strategic military strategies there. It's coming up to 6:15, and after this, we're going to be looking at the question of a video of the Texas church shooting, which has emerged. The question is, who should see it? We'll discuss after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Tide Is High by Blondie. 6:20 right now, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Joyce Goh and Brian Fernandez here with me as we take a look at some of the biggest news of the day. Now, there's been it's been revealed that a video has emerged showing the 7 minutes of gunfire of the black-clad gunman executing his victims inside the First Baptist Church in Texas. So the question is, I mean, we've all heard the news of the Texas church shooting and how that's a terrible tragedy. But now that this video is out there and we've been made aware of its existence, the question is whether to ever release this video or to keep them permanently out of sight. So what do you guys think? Do you think that this video should be made available?
I think it should be out of sight.
Okay, so delete permanently.
Victims and their families, and yeah, it should not be at all.
What about you, Brian?
No, I think that, okay, so I take the opposing view that perhaps we should release this so that, you know, people need to understand sometimes the horror, because we're so detached sometimes. Crimes happen all the time. Terrorism, for example, and this is a terrorist act or you know,
domestic terrorism.
Domestic,
yeah.
Terrorism. That really, we are so sensitized to acts of violence.
Desensitized.
Now. Desensitized, mm-hmm. Sorry. To acts of violence now. It doesn't impact us as much anymore. So sometimes releasing something like this really helps to bring perspective back to all of us.
But the fact that so many people died in,
yeah, 26
in the
people
church
died.
Is enough to for everyone to realize the horror of the event. You don't have to see the video, right? Well, I don't know, that's just my take.
Yeah, okay. So right now, the video is with the authorities. So releasing this video could affect the investigation that's currently happening. It could re-traumatize the families of the victims, as you said, Joyce. And it could also, you know, once it's gone online, there's no taking it back. Think of all the people who, you know, the online voyeurs and the conspiracy theorists who will use this video to feed their, you know, their need, for instance.
Yeah, and also let's look at the past. In the past, those that, for example, there were videos that captured parts of the Pulse nightclub shooting in 2016, the Fort Hood attack in 2009. Also in Tucson, there was a shooting as well of the former representative Gabrielle Giffords in 2011. All of those videos were never released to the public.
But if you know, it just takes a few Google searches to find that security camera footage of the Columbine High School rampage in 2019. So there are videos of, you know, captured on CCTV or someone's cell phone that's out there of mass shootings, and really no one's kind of looking at it or regulating it. But in this age where everyone kind of whips out their handphone whenever something happens to record it, it's really hard to control. I think at the end of the day, it's a question of whether the media should be the ones to carry this. So for instance, I'm still affected. I don't know about you, but you know that picture of the Syrian refugee boy that drowned on the beach. I can still vividly picture that image in my head. And I remember seeing it unbidden. Like, I didn't go looking for it. I came across it. I can't even remember which news outlet it was, but it was kind of smack in your face, really quite hard to scroll down or to flip the page. And that image just stayed with me. And that's become the representation for the Syrian refugee crisis for me. Mm-hmm. And it really is that pictures speak 1,000 words. While a narrative can do a lot of explainings, images tend to be quite haunting. So in a way, I do agree with you, Brian, that there is a reason to perhaps view or to have, you know, this video accessible to certain members of the public.
And how do you determine certain members of the public?
Yeah,
that's the challenge.
That's a big challenge. I would say perhaps not the public, but I would make it available to people in policy making, those who oppose gun control, for instance, or who are not doing anything in the backlash of this shooting. They should be made public to see the horrors of what this does,
yeah,
right?
That should be on the NRA website, actually.
All right, well, tell us what you think. Do you think that these videos of, you know, mass shootings should be released or keep them permanently out of sight? WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got Oasis up next with Some Might Say. BFM 89.9. It's 6:40 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Joyce Gilbrand Fernandez here with me, and Belle and Sebastian with Suicide Girl. All right, well, let's take a recent look. Let's take a look at Facebook, because, you know, given the recent news that we've been seeing about Russia's covert campaign to influence the US presidential elections last year using social media, Facebook especially, you know, that could change the way many of us feel about using Facebook. It's no longer just, a social media or a platform to get, you know, to find out what our friends are up to. The problem is, even if you do feel slightly squeamish about not knowing what goes on under the hood of Facebook, you still will find it really hard to cut Facebook out of your life. So really the question is just kind of to take a look at how much time we personally spend on social media. What about you guys, Brian and Joyce? How much time do you spend on social media?
You know, I've gone on a little detox. I tried it during my birthday period, actually. I didn't log in.
During your birthday period?
Yes.
So you refrained from all the birthday wishes?
Absolutely,
on
and I feel really bad now after doing that because I didn't say thank you to people. So if you're listening to me on air, I'm so sorry, guys. But the reality is precisely for this, because, you know, we are bombarded with so many different messages and the time that it takes. I'm not a Facebooker in general in terms of posting. I get tagged to a lot of activities that I do and so forth. And so I thought it would be a good digital detox to really try to stay away from it a little bit. And you know what? After a while, it's not so bad.
What about you, Joyce?
I'm more on Instagram, okay. But I check my Facebook also every day, perhaps about 15 minutes.
All right. If
you add up
50.
So you're a very light user then.
But between, I just check just capo what's happening because I find Facebook a bit spammy.
Okay, hang on. So, you know, you were surprised at the 15 minutes or 50 minutes, right? 15 or 50. Apparently, the average Facebook user spends 50 minutes a day. And not just with Facebook, but, you know, if you count Facebook Messenger and Instagram, because, you know, Facebook
Instagram,
owns.
Yeah, when I check my Instagram, I check my Facebook.
Kind of, you know, I think in our minds, social media is one on the same. I don't have a Facebook account. I've resisted this long.
Brilliant. Wow, very good.
But Twitter is the time suck for me. It really is. You know, yesterday, and I'll use this example yesterday, I came back from the gym and, you know, I was tired and sweaty. And I thought, okay, I'll hop into the shower, but let me just check what I've missed in the past 1 hour. And before you know it, it was 45 minutes. Gone.
Wow.
Because I was on Twitter. 40. Yeah. I looked at my watch again and went, oh, wait a minute. What time is it?
Social media does that to you, you know?
So this is exactly why I went on the detox.
It's a black hole. It's a black hole. All right. Well, anyway, rigorous research confirms that using Facebook is somewhat detrimental to physical and mental health. In fact, this is all kind of sophisticated behavioral design that makes Facebook and other social media apps more addictive than any slot machine. So really, the fear is when you quit social media, you fear missing out. And what most people have found is that quitting means you get your time and your focus back. So really, how do you make sure that your attempt to quit social media sticks? Because more often than not, it doesn't.
So I think what I did probably is the classic example. You don't log in. I mean, strangely enough, it was logged in on my phone, but I never actually looked at it.
Okay.
So stuff happened or whatever, but essentially what I did is every maybe couple of days, I would just take a quick look for a few seconds and that was it. But it's still a detox. I mean, I see the producer here making faces at me.
But there is a simple hack though, Joyce, for you if you want to quit social media or even Facebook. Why don't you tell us what that simple hack is?
Well, that's logging out of the account. Actually, like consciously logging out of your social media account. So you don't have to quit. So this is where instead of quitting the whole social media platform, you just stop using it by logging out as like what Brian does. And then you don't go back and check.
I don't even know what my password is. It's been so long since
so that's
I logged
how
out.
It works, right? So that's what this article is saying.
Okay, it's coming on to 6:45. After this, we're going to be taking a look at why Malaysians continue to use handphones while driving. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That coming into Los Angeles by Arlo Guthrie there. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Melissa, Joyce and Brian. 6:49 right now. And a recent study carried out by the Malaysian Institute of Road Safety Research, or MIROS, has found that the majority of Malaysian drivers use their mobile phones while driving. So this was a study carried out on 300 random responders in the Klang Valley. 43% say they use mobile phones while driving cars or riding motorbikes. 53% use while they're caught in traffic congestion. And 53% also said they text while driving at least 1 to 3 times a week. More than 60% said they receive phone calls while driving at least once or three times a week. Guys, I am red-faced and shamed on air because I'm probably one of many people who do this. And I feel so guilty.
You know what? I think these numbers are so low compared
to reality.
I think most people...
Someone's laughing here.
So because most people, for example, and I'm guilty of that, I don't answer phone calls,
Yeah, I don't answer phone calls either.
I don't text in terms of when I'm driving. But hey... I have Waze on. I'm using my mobile phone.
That's true. Traffic light sometimes. You just want to check who's texted you.
Traffic light sometimes. Yes.
Traffic jams. I'm laughing because I'm guilty.
You're so guilty. Okay. All right. Look, you know, it's not still, you know, it's no laughing matter. You're right, though. I have to say, Waze, sometimes when you use this kind of navigation apps, and I can't imagine life without using these navigation apps anymore. Even if I know the way, sometimes I'm just checking out the traffic congestion and what time I'm, you know, going to arrive. So you've got, you know, it's better to have one of those, I guess, the hold on the dashboard.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, you're still, you know, either making changes while you're driving or zooming in to see what's the next turn coming up. That's still, you're right, Brian, it's still using your phone.
Waze. Yeah, absolutely.
So we spoke to Ko Mui Han, the CEO of Drava, which is a locally developed app that's helping to improve road safety by tracking the movements and behavior of drivers. So here he is sharing with us why he thinks bad habits are hard to change when it comes to driving.
I think for changing habits of any kind, not even just driving, I think it's particularly hard because this certain way that our cells or brains have been wired to. And I find that most people don't like to change their habits or behaviors unless there's very extreme changes in their life. So year after year, we have government pushing up for higher penalties, higher fines. But you can still see that our road accident numbers is increasing year on year. Road accident-related deaths are also increasing. So I think the way to go is really to incentivize. And one good way is actually just like Drava, we are trying to work with the motor insurance company to look at how we can reward safer drivers for driving safe.
So Ko also told us that this reward system can work in tandem with insurance companies and the kind of technology that Drava uses and if it addresses the problem of using our phones while driving.
Correct. In Malaysia, motor insurance is mandatory, so everybody needs to buy a motor insurance if you want to drive. Now with the Bank Negara's move to de-tariff the motor insurance product, starting this year and all the way until 2020, we are going to face de-tariffication. There is an opportunity for insurance company to actually offer variable pricing based on the driver's risk profile. Now, the only challenge with that is before this, the insurance companies have never collected real-time data for their customers. So that's where the tech comes in very handy. So with driving apps like Drava and others, which can actually collect data as the drivers drive, can actually become a very important key point to this puzzle, providing the insurers with a good idea of how a particular consumer behaves on the road. And with that, actually helps to further give them a leeway to whether lower the premiums for the safer drivers or even increase for the not-so-safe drivers. Yeah.
We also wanted to find out how effective he thinks these apps are.
For current phone usage app, there's actually two kinds. There's one that permanently blocks you while you drive. Once you hit a certain speed limit, you cannot use your phone at all, whether it's receiving text messages, phone calls, or even you can't on your phone or you can't play around with it. Until you stop to a certain level, then that helps. We find that kind of method in Malaysia is a little bit challenging because most of us are very attached to our phone and we do a lot of things with our phone. So hence, blocking it then makes people more angry and eventually they will just delete the apps. I think the second type of apps works just like Drava, which is actually just to give you a reminder or give you an understanding of what you've done. So one of the key challenges in changing behavior is we cannot change anything that we don't know or we cannot measure. But if there's a constant measurement of every trip that I do, how many times I play with my phone for certain kilometers, and that message being sent to me, or better still, send to a loved one. So we have designed our app also to have a mentor-mentee system, which I can nominate a mentor, and particularly these are for the younger drivers, so that they nominate their parents, so that the parents or the mentors can actually get a report of what I do and don't do on the road. And that, I believe, is the way to go. We still got to target the younger ones to start with, because generally, I think the older folks are really hard to change for their set behaviours over the last 10, 20 or 30 years. But those who are coming out from driving institute, driving schools, they are just beginning to drive. These are the people that we need to instill and push this behavioral change at their age. Yeah.
That was Koh Mui Han, the CEO of Drava, which is a locally developed app helping to improve road safety by tracking the movements and behavior of drivers. What do you guys think about this mentor-mentee system, Ryan Joyce? What do you guys
think? Pretty clever.
Yeah. You know, the most effective, I think, is when my niece told me, Auntie Melly, you really shouldn't be using your phone when you're driving. And that was so effective. I think we should get kids to tell their parents.
Absolutely. I'm the same as well. But my daughter tells me something like, behavior modification happens.
Yes, when the little ones watch you.
Absolutely. But coming back to this, one of the key things with this is, and how they're working with insurance companies, we have de-tarification. So when you have behavior modification, it can actually affect you in terms of reducing your insurance premiums.
Oh, yeah, there you go. All right, well, everyone put your phones away and listen to the radio while you're in the car, because we've got Can't Help But Smiling by Davendra Banhart here on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 7 minutes past 7 o'clock. It's Tuesday, the 14th of November. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez and Joyce Goh, here to catch you up on all the news you need to know as you start your day. Of course, we're going to be looking at Trump's visit to Asia as that wraps up and what impacts that could have on markets, as well as a look at how the newspapers have framed the news of the day. The Star has dubbed a woman dubbed by The Star as Monster Mum for prostituting her preteen daughters. That's on the front page of The Star. We're going to be taking a quick look at that, as well as other news on MRT3 for the business pages. So make sure you stay tuned. That's all coming up in the next hour. But first, a follow-up on the news we discussed yesterday about the Taman Desa residents suing the KL mayor over a new condo project. So a group of 11 Taman Desa residents have filed a lawsuit against the KL mayor. This is to stop a condominium project that is going to be about 3 to 4 times higher than their existing condominiums. So to get a better understanding of this issue, we spoke to Philip Pang, the spokesman for the community-driven Save Taman Desa Coalition. We asked him what made him and his fellow residents challenge the KL mayor over the new development projects in the neighbourhood.
Well, there were a couple of things, right? The first thing was the people or residents in Taman Desa were shocked when they discovered that there was a proposal to increase population density by more than tenfold, from the present 60 persons per acre to 650 persons per acre. And further looking into this matter, it was then discovered that this proposed project would have buildings above 30 stories. Okay, you had about 3 blocks of buildings that's above 30 stories. And the highest building that we have in Taman Desa so far is no more than 25 stories. But to compound matters further, we found that this project was actually located next to 3 schools, 2 primary schools and 1 secondary school. And it's on a piece of land that's designated, or as far as we know, is designated for Tanaga National Reserve. It's a very narrow strip of land. So, well, that being said and all, the residents were invited under the Kaedah 5 to go to DBKL and express their objections. And that was done. But DBKL did not respond. And there was no acknowledgement of the objections having been received. So I guess it just brought things to a boil when the residents discovered from the KPKT OSC portal that, planning approval and all that was given by DBKL. and it was not notified to the residents at all. So I suppose that basically summed up the whole thing, you know, that got the residents upset, and they decided to get together and say, let's do something about it.
In other reports, Philip also mentioned that the infrastructure in Taman Desa is way out of date. He shares some insight on this matter.
Well, okay, now, Taman Desa first received its residents back in 1977-78. It was planned and designed in the 70s. Taman Desa was actually not that well known until 1996. But in 1996, when Taman Danau Desa opened up, the connection to the Salak interchange, the East-West Link, opened up. And that made Taman Desa more popular. I mean, it was good news for Taman Desa, right? But what we have seen is the roads remain the same. There's no proper, you know, even resurfacing being done. Okay, only when you complain when there are potholes, you get resurfacing done. Since 1978 until now, there's only one single public transport service, which is a bus service that operates once every 30 minutes. And it only takes you from Taman Desa down to KL Central Market, thereabouts. And many residents, if not everybody here, has been complaining about low water pressure. You know, water pressure keeps dropping whenever there's a new project that comes on stream. And it seems like there's no coordination between all the relevant public services. The planning, I would say, is all micro-planning. But nobody actually sits back and says, hey, let's look at the whole picture. If we do this, what's going to happen there? What's going to happen here? So if you say what infrastructure, basically from roads, public transport amenities, in terms of the water pipelines, you know, electricity supply, all that, you know, it needs to be upgraded to cater for the increase in population.
So what's next for the Taman Desa residents in this case? Philip has many proposals to move forward.
So I suppose the way forward is to get people aware of what's going on, give them the right information, and getting the right and updated information from the relevant authorities is very important, because we find that to be difficult, okay? Because we found that certain information are not updated and so on. At the same time, we don't want to oppose development. We want development, okay? We want it to be sustainable. We need some green lungs. We need some spaces. So these are things that we are looking at. And I reckon that with the increased awareness, we'll have greater participation. And maybe this will also create awareness among other people, not just in Taman Desa, but outside of Taman Desa as well, that we need to look at development in a more holistic manner.
That was Philip Pang, spokesman for Save Taman Desa, the coalition of residents protesting developments in their neighbourhood. You know, I mean, this is not the first case that we've seen, you know, where you've got a coalition of residents coming together, right, Brian and Joyce? Recently, there was news as well of Taman Tun residents coming together over Bukit Kiara development.
Yes.
Yeah, so the key thing is, the residents in this case are proactive. They've come together. Fortunately, they've been able to come together before the developments actually take place, because you and I know the moment the development actually starts, there's no turning back. The moment the bulldozers are there, that's it. It's all over. But and I'm of the view, which I share with Philip, really, we really need to have more holistic planning. Mm. I mean, KL in a nutshell, as someone has pointed out, really is about micro planning rather than master planning. And in this case, that's a classic example. Taman Desa is an old neighbourhood. It's a very lovely green neighbourhood. It's got new developments as well. The basic infrastructure, if you drive there, it's exactly the same.
Yeah, and to see, like he shared, the roads there and how the bus services is
one bus. Can you imagine?
That operates, and there's so many people are living there, and it's great that they're coming together to challenge this. But it's just how it's. I'm not sure how that will push forward the
yeah,
movie?
It's
are
going
there
to
any cases where residents have challenged the developer and they've won?
Well, I honestly don't know the answer to that, but the lawyer representing the 11 residents in this case, Sharizan Johan, he himself has noted, look, it's going to be a tough one. They're going to be faced with various challenges. Things like, you know, getting information is going to be difficult. The court process is going to be costly. So
yeah,
where are you going to get
expensive.
The funds for that? Yeah. Mm. So all these things, I think, will be taken into consideration if the court cases are filed. So let's keep a close eye on that. But what we're also going to keep an eye on is the front pages of today's papers. That's in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.